What was one of your lowest moments on your journey, even up until this point?
I just remember there was a moment where we had a small payroll at the time, but we had payroll and cash was getting very down to the wire. And we were looking around at each other, myself and other co-founder, very early employee also. And it was very easy for the mood to just be, anybody could have blurted out, well, I guess that's it. Like, we're done. It was so close to that being the moment that it's like, well, I guess this is it. It's been fun. Good luck to everybody. I just remember in that moment, what was needed was for me to be like, I'm never giving up. We're going to get through this. There's something here and we just can't give up. And then it flipped right away. Everybody else was like, okay, we're never giving up. That was a very difficult moment because it felt like I'd lost the whole team. And even if I'm being honest, I was faking it. Was I telling the truth about never giving up? It felt I was about to give up, but I just had to put on that face. And then when other people responded, being like, yeah, we're never giving up, I was like, okay, we're never giving up. Like we're going to keep doing it.
We're on a mission to help founders hit product market fit faster. We do this by interviewing founders that have been there. I'm your host, Adam O'Donnell. This podcast is put together by Zendesk for Startups. We offer 6 months free of Zendesk customer support suite for qualified product-oriented companies.
Mark, welcome to Sit Down Startup Founder Podcast. I'm super excited to understand your story of hitting product market fit with Alexi. If you could just first start with like, when did you know you wanted to be a founder?
Yeah, it probably goes back quite a ways. I would say there was some probably subconscious realization that my parents were entrepreneurs, not in tech at all, but were entrepreneurs and ran a small business for much of their life. And I think when I was in undergrad studying, knowing that I was getting very interested in technology, kind of building stuff on the side. And when I went into law school, I could kind of see this other side of the creative, sort of non-creative, the kind of the opposite end of the spectrum where you're not really being creative. You're just executing a fairly well-defined process of completing a certain amount of work. And the difference between building, being creative, and a more traditional legal practice was very stark. And it became abundantly clear to me that I wanted to be building. I wanted to be creating things in the world. It was really during law school that, I mean, I loved law school. It was great, but it solidified my understanding that I really want to be building.
Very interesting. So you went to law school, you finished. Did you go and practice law or did you start a startup?
I worked in a law firm for a year. And then it was right after that, that's when I started Alexi.
Very cool. I mean, just if we could double tap on that moment, because that decision to jump out of the comfort of a full-time job, making good money, and then to go to a startup, what pushed you over the line and kind of what were you weighing in that moment?
People say this often, but I think it's totally true. Like if you're thinking about things and you can't fall asleep, if you're in the shower thinking about this idea that wouldn't it be so cool to do this, if you're telling your friends about it, like this should really exist, like why doesn't it exist? That just became clear to me. And I was very much of the mindset that, look, there's nothing stopping you, go out and do it. I was just about to get married also at the time, or I think we just got married. So I had to convince my wife that it was the right thing to do. And so once I was over that hurdle, I think it was a no-brainer. The fact that I had done law school, I had a profession I could go back to, I think there was a bit of a safety net there maybe that made it a little bit easier for me, but it was very straightforward. I had this idea that I couldn't stop thinking about. It was some practical considerations, but yeah, I just jumped right in.
That's so inspiring. I'm trying to really just like help shed light on founders who are at that point. Maybe they're at 3 months away from quitting. What were you doing at that point, would you say? Were you building the MVP? Did you already get investment commitment or did you just have some savings and you're like, I'm going to try this for 6 months? Like what was your mindset then?
No, definitely did not have savings. Came out of law school still kind of with some student debt for sure. And that was definitely some of these practical considerations. But no, we went several years before we raised any sort of meaningful amount of money. I was working, I think it was about a year and a half until I started taking the first little bit of salary. So it was bare bones. My wife hadn't had an income at the time. And so she was kind of supporting and we were on this in it together that, okay, we're just going to go through and I'm not going to earn a salary until it makes sense. And then we had some money come in. We went through Techstars. We had some money come in, had a smaller angel round come together. And then, yeah, and that even at 3 months left to go, like you said, 3 months is quite a while. The biggest thing is just keep surviving because things keep happening. And if you push things in the right direction, if you're doing all the right things on a day-to-day basis and continue to evaluate that, every day can be significant. Every week certainly can be significant. A month is a lifetime almost, right? And it's really the ability to just keep surviving every single day and things eventually build up and add up. And just like building a snowball, right? It has that effect.
I love that. Before you dive into the product market fit piece, now that you've raised over $10 million, you have an amazing team and you raised some really respectful investors like Draper and Techstars, like you said, just so cool to see. What was one of your lowest moments on your journey, even up until this point?
I just remember there was a moment where we had a small payroll at the time, but we had payroll and cash was getting very down to the wire. And we were looking around at each other, myself and other co-founder, very early employee also. And it was very easy for the mood to just be, anybody could have blurted out, well, I guess that's it. Like, we're done. It was so close to that being the moment that it's like, well, I guess this is it. It's been fun. Good luck to everybody. I just remember in that moment, what was needed was for me to be like, I'm never giving up. We're going to get through this. There's something here and we just can't give up. And then it flipped right away. Everybody else was like, okay, we're never giving up. It was a very difficult moment because it felt like I'd lost the whole team. And even if I'm being honest, I was faking it. Was I telling the truth about never giving up? It felt I was about to give up, but I just had to put on that face. And then when other people responded being like, yeah, we're never giving up, I was like, okay, we're never giving up. Like we're going to keep doing it.
Wow. What a moment. It's like you spoke it into existence. Basically, like we're going, even you kind of acted your way into how you actually felt, which was not confident in that moment. I appreciate you sharing that and just being vulnerable. It's like every single founder has so many stories like that. And I know just before we started recording, when I asked you low moments, you're like, oh man, which one?
I know. Well, then there's so many, there's others I would love to talk about. And one day I will. That one was a while ago, but there's other crazy, very intense moments that I think, with each one of these moments, it's like, it can get so much worse. It's actually nowhere near as bad as you think right now. And there's always things to try. There's always possibilities. There's always plans. There's always another option, always. So it's a matter of figuring out what it is. And that's really key to remember. It has been for me.
That's good. There's always another option, even if you don't see it. When would you say the month or quarter that you were confident that you had hit product market fit with Alexi?
There was one moment in particular where we were going through this program in Toronto. A lot of fairly well-known startups had gone through this program. It was a program where you would meet with a bunch of mentors in the morning, and then in the afternoon, you'd be put in a room and basically listen to all the mentors debate your company. And you couldn't speak up, but you would just listen to them debate the merits of your company, the challenges, the things you'd have to work on. And it was a very cool program. And they had what was called this super session, where it was not just the 20 or 30 mentors that you spoke with, but all the mentors in the entire program. I think there's a couple hundred, not just in Toronto, right from Silicon Valley, New York City, like all over, that came together for this program. And we got selected to be a part of this super session. And so we get called up, we're standing there. And then now there's these people in this room of 200 of these mentors, VCs, angel investors, successful entrepreneurs, all these incredible people. And now we're expected to just stand there and listen to a few people stand up with a microphone, talk about our company. We didn't know this, but one of our very early customers, there was a connection with somebody organizing this super session, and they had invited them to come to the session to talk to everybody in the room about their use of the product, their experience with the product. And it's a well-known, prestigious litigation law firm in Toronto, our customer. We didn't know that they were going to be there until we see them and somebody says, okay, now Alexi's here. And we just thought it would be cool to hear from one of their customers. And here I'm thinking like, oh my goodness, they've been a customer for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, maybe new customer. We were so excited when we landed this customer also. And I'm like, I think it's been going well. Like my conversations with them have been going well, but I have no idea what they're going to say now in front of all these people. And then they went on this like 5 to 10 minute glowing praise of our product. It's changed their business. They're like, I can't, it's amazing what these guys have built. The tool is unbelievable. Here's how it's changing our law firm. Here's how it's changed how we think about technology going forward. Here are plans to integrate it even more. We're just sitting there like the previous sessions of this program, people are like, this is never going to work. Lawyers don't buy technology. It's inefficient. And then now it's like, holy smokes, we're standing up here in front of this room of 200 people. And one of the most prestigious in the country is now singing our praises in front of this huge room. And it was like, how do we fail now? Like, that's what it felt like in the moment. It's like, I think we've made it. I think that that's what this feels like. And so that was a huge turning moment for us. And after this session, it was like half the room, it felt like, had put their hands up. Like, yeah, we want to take a meeting with this company. So it was wild. Like if it was in a movie, that would be like the climax of the movie, right? Of us starting the company. So yeah.
What a cool moment. I feel like we can all visualize that right now, especially if you're listening. Help me with like going back. So how long was that after you had quit your job and started the company?
That was 3 years.
Wow. So if we go back to day one, you just put in your notice with the law firm. What is that first season, maybe a quarter, look like and how you're spending your time? Where is the product? How many people are on the team? Customers you're talking to per week, that kind of stuff.
If I were to go back and do those first 3 years again, I'd probably do them quite differently now. I mean, hindsight's obviously 2020, but for those 3 years, at least before we'd raised any sort of significant amount of money, we were a very small team, less than five for that whole 5 year period. We had some contractors that we were working with, but yeah, we kept our core team really quite small. And yeah, I was building product, mainly the actual product and the front end that the users would see and interact with. And my co-founder, our CTO at the time, he was building a lot of the back end that was needed to make the product work. And we were building a RAG implementation for law firms without even knowing that it was RAG. Like RAG wasn't a thing. So this was the very early language models throwing on top of retrieval results to give a way better legal research experience. So that was what we were building. I also, and I still have this view that if you spend too much time talking to law firms, you would probably build the wrong product. That too many people, and this was true in the pre-ChatGPT days of legal tech, lawyers did not appreciate the potential of AI, potential of the technology. And so they were going to be very limiting if you let them direct your product too much. Definitely getting feedback, hearing how they're using the product that you built, how they think about it, how they talk about it, learning more about their business. It's a very specialized business, the practice of law. All of those things were really important to get a better understanding of. But definitely we felt like we had to innovate on behalf of the customers. We're not going to find the best product idea from our customers. We had to come up with it and then validate it with the customers. And so that's really what we spent the time doing. I'm very much of the view that it's not finding product market fit, it's product market wedge. You force the product into the market until you convince and prove to the market that this is the right product. And it takes time to do that. Ultimately, the process of innovation is starting with a non-conventional contrarian idea and convincing the market that it's right until it's conventional. And so that's a struggle. That's a struggle. Like you have to believe so strongly, you have to have such high conviction in your product and in your idea to put that non-conventional idea out there and receive that backlash, but be so determined and so disciplined to eventually make it conventional. But you got to be right. Your contrarian non-conventional idea has to be right. It has to provide value. It has to be a better way of doing things. And just over time, gradually, you convince people until it's conventional. And that's when the innovation process, I think, is there and you achieve it.
That's amazing advice. I'm curious, how did you get to conviction if you had only been a lawyer for a year?
I think that was an advantage. I had enough exposure, but not too much that I couldn't think like a non-lawyer. You have to be able to think like a non-lawyer to be able to innovate for the law firms. But you have to have enough insight into the business of law and how the practice actually works to be able to innovate. I see people who are 3, 4, 5 years in a law firm, and it's really tough for them to make that switch now and start to think in non-conventional ways. 1 year was probably just enough for me to get some exposure, but not so much that I could no longer think in non-conventional ways with the naivety that this is actually going to work.
Was there a moment, like, because most people, when I ask about the conviction phase, it's based on prospect interactions and just like ideas. They don't have the product yet, but they're just like talking to enough people. Maybe it's 10 to 50 to 100. But what I'm hearing from you is you just kind of knew it based on being in it. And then is that right? Or is there anything else on this thing?
No, we did do a fair bit of discovery, but the discovery that we did were trying to get information on like what we could expect from user behavior, not around what should the product be. We had very strong conviction on what the product should be. And that was arrived at from a first principles approach. Like, is this truly more efficient? Is there definitely more value in doing it this way? And if that's right, then it's all the discovery is around figuring out go-to-market, figuring out messaging, figuring out all these things. That's what the user discovery was. And another analogy, nobody's ever going to tell you the real reason why they buy a product or use a product. The data is going to tell you. The data is going to tell you what is valuable to the user or to a group of users. And that's going to be far more accurate than what they actually tell you. Let's get enough data so that we can see some signal to find what people are actually finding valuable. And then we can follow those data trends to get to building more and more value into the product.
It's so simple what you're describing, because it's like, it reminds me of just the jobs to be done concept where like the things that people are trying to do doesn't really change. It's just like, can you take steps out of their process to getting to the ultimate outcome that they're trying to achieve? No one cares about software. They care about the outcome that it delivers them. So it sounds like you just like put that together. Could you describe the first principles pitch that you had in your mind with your co-founder in one or two sentences, that just so people know what it is?
Yeah. So the first one is, this is the bigger vision. If we build an AI that knows the law, it unlocks this opportunity to do so many different things for lawyers, that it's really building an AI that knows the law. And so what that looked like for us at the time is, when somebody has a question about the law, like what the law says, can we properly point them to the right cases, the right legislation, and understand that primary law, the cases and legislation, sufficiently well so that we can summarize and put an answer together? So it's basically RAG, retrieval augmented generation, but that was the first iteration of the product, is being able to put an essay or a memo-like response in front of the user to answer their legal question instead of the 10 blue links. So it's very much like the shift from a Google interface to a ChatGPT. It's exactly what we were trying to build for legal research. A shift from the traditional Thomson Reuters product of, they even say, we found 100,000 cases that are relevant to this query. And you know, it's like, okay, the user does not want 100,000 cases to have to read through. They just want the top 5, 6, 7 cases, and they want them synthesized in a way that gives a coherent answer to their question. And that was the initial product insight. From a first principles, we thought that was a way better legal research experience than having to go in and dig through these 100,000 links to figure out what might be relevant.
I love that. And no, you didn't have to talk to any lawyer for them to confirm that. Well, yeah, if you could actually do this, like, of course, and you know that because they're already paying for attorneys, like they're using other associates to answer the questions that they would be posing to AI in some examples. And last question, what would you do differently? You mentioned that in the beginning. What was like the biggest change that you would have done in your approach from like year 0 to 3 year or 5?
We knew that these foundational models were improving quite quickly. We did not predict the pretty big jump we saw with GPT-4. And there were some of our competitors like Casetext and also eventually Harvey had early access to GPT-4 months in advance of us or other companies. And that caused us to make some decisions like, how much do we invest in foundational model development or even trying to do some pre-training of our own? And that was definitely a mistake in how we were trying to build defensibility, build real proprietary value in the product and in the company. And we probably should have just leaned more sooner into the incredible power in these foundational models, especially when you combine them all together and start to get this scaffolding of the value that's built up, and leave the significant R&D to these foundational model companies. And where can we provide additional industry specific value for our customers? And there's still a huge gap between what the ChatGPT or any of these foundational models can do for our customers and what they actually need. And that's where we focus now very much on just filling that gap. Whereas we didn't for quite a while. We thought we had to be this hardcore AI R&D company to really build this AI that knows the law. But again, we didn't anticipate the large language models improving as fast as they did.
That's an amazing point. And it's like you outsource the things that your core competencies, and you know law better than anyone else in terms of like a lawyer's experience and end-to-end use case. And like you're building defensibility through that versus being able to build an LLM that like applies to it. Is what I'm hearing.
Right. Yeah. There's a bunch of things around technical decisions that we made that probably, I mean, every company has things like this that like, if we go back and change that, we probably should have. Also around distribution, focusing on go-to-market distribution, unlocking, thinking about distribution in the same way we think about product, that it's this non-conventional either channel or message that is right. And thinking about distribution the same way with that same framework that applies to product and trying to be innovative around distribution. And that's still something that we think a lot about today. That's we should have done like that way sooner.
That is so good. Well, this has been amazing. I know we only booked 25 to 30 minutes, but I'm curious if there's a founder who wanted to reach out to you, would the best platform be LinkedIn or X?
Both's fine. Email is probably best, just mark@alexi.com, but LinkedIn, X is fine. Yeah.
Mark, thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about Zendesk for Startups, check out our website, zendesk.com/startups. Also, we're always looking to improve, so don't hesitate to email me with any feedback on how we can ask better questions, guess the target, or anything else that we can do to better help you as a founder. My email is adam.odonnell@zendesk.com.